Welcome to Common Ground Berlin, where we delve into important issues that matter to you in the German capital and beyond. I'm your host, Soraya Sarhadi Nelson. You may ask why you should care about today's topic. The presidential election in the United States this year is an American election, after all. How does that affect us all the way over here? The truth is, the outcome of this election could dramatically change U.S. foreign policy. And with two major wars heavily influenced by Washington that are in danger of spreading, that's an especially big deal this time around. So even if you're not a U.S. citizen living in Berlin, you may gain some valuable insight from our podcast today. And if you are an American citizen, you will learn how you can make a difference. Before our experts weigh in, let's find out what about the American vote abroad is guile or not so guile. As an American voter, what's guile is that we can vote overseas. Many countries don't let you do that, whether by law or practice. For example, Morocco and to a large extent Ireland strip their overseas citizens of the right to vote. And in Malta and Israel, voters must cast their ballots at home rather than overseas. What's not so guile as an American voter overseas is that your ability to vote can be made more difficult depending on what state you register to vote in. My first guest, Constance Chocholowski, will tell us why. She's the chairman of the Berlin Chapter of Democrats Abroad, which is the official organization for American Democrats who live overseas. There's no Republican counterpart to your group, right?
There is an organization called Republicans Overseas that sort of stumps for Republicans, but they're not official in the same capacity that Democrats Abroad is. We belong officially to the Democratic Party, and there's no counterpart to that for the Republicans.
So why is it that U.S. states get to decide how U.S. citizens vote, even in national elections?
In the United States, voting is a state issue, so the state registrars of voters determine how the process functions, and every state does that differently. So there are some states that allow for mail-in ballots. There are some states that, even if you're not voting from abroad, have different dates for voting, early, etc. So as states decide that, they also decide the registration process for Americans voting from abroad. Of course, all of us really are voting through a mail-in process, but the registration process sometimes forces you to mail in your registration. Sometimes you can do it online. Sometimes you need a wet signature, essentially. And sometimes you have to essentially print out everything you're doing and then contact your registrar of voters and make sure that they know that your registration is coming, things like that. So part of what Democrats Abroad does is really clarify that situation per state for the voters that are registering to vote from abroad and are voting from abroad.
So U.S. citizens can't just go to the U.S. embassy here in Berlin and vote if they wanted to vote and are doing it for the first time.
No. So I think for other countries, that's sometimes the case. In your federal elections, there's long lines outside of, for instance, the Italian embassy. That's not the case for the U.S. Sometimes the embassy allows you to mail your ballot to the embassy before it sort of packages all the ballots that it receives and then sends them to the U.S. That's not the easiest process, essentially, because so many states allow you to vote by mail. And we're thrilled that the acknowledgement of voting by mail has grown, even for Americans living in the United States, really since COVID. But it makes the process, of course, much easier. However, not just the registration process, the voting process is also different by state. So there are really specific instructions per state about how to fill out your ballot, how to seal the envelope. So really critical things that we want to help voters ensure they're doing correctly so that their vote counts.
Are there any states that actually make it impossible to vote if you're an expat?
No, you are legally allowed to vote in every single state. And imagine expats aren't treated differently than, for instance, military service members who are serving currently abroad. So there is a process for each American who is a citizen, who is over the age of 18, to vote from abroad. But in the actual instructions, there are things that make it incredibly difficult, whether it's providing the right address or knowing what the time period is for requesting your ballots, things like that. So that's where, again, we want to be really careful to make sure that all of the Americans living abroad know exactly what they need to do and know it early as opposed to sort of a few weeks out from general election day in November.
Americans who live overseas and are eligible to vote are a formidable block. I mean, according to the Federal Voting Assistance Program, there are at least 2.8 million such voters, which is a bigger population than in 15 of 50 U.S. states. And yet, stateside voters are 18 times more likely to vote than expat voters. Why is that?
The voter turnout of Americans living abroad is really quite low. We estimate that in 2020, it was about 7% globally. So of those 2.8 million that you were talking about, and that's even lower in a midterm election, estimated about 4.8% in 2022. We want that to be as high as possible. And one of the problems is really barriers to voting. So the complexity of what I just described, both requesting your ballot, and that needs to be done for all voters living overseas every single calendar year. Whereas if you're in the United States, even if you're voting via mail-in ballot, you may be registered for a much longer period of time. You might just have to register once in certain states, and then you always receive the ballots or can go to the polls to vote. That is not the case for Americans abroad. And so if you don't make sure that you are registered early, there's a possibility that you're not receiving via email or via mail the ballots that you need in order to vote from abroad in a particular state. And so it's really confusion, I think, in a big sense. Of course, there are some Americans who might just be following the process less because if you're living in the United States during an election year, I think we're all aware of this, you're constantly bombarded by the fact that an election is taking place. And that's less the case, although I think it is still a lot of bombardment when you're living outside of the United States. But I think the biggest barrier is process. And not dealing with that process early.
What state do you have to register in to vote if you want to cast your ballot from overseas?
You are forced to vote in the state in which you were last registered. I myself was registered to vote in the state of Wisconsin when I left the United States, and so that is where I vote. I vote at the last address at which I was registered. At the same time, there are really specific cases, for instance, children of Americans living overseas that have never voted before. They are American citizens and then they turn 18. They, for instance, need to use their parents' last voting address. So there are real complications to this that I think it would be helpful to ask somebody, what do I do in this special case? And of course, that's why we exist and that's what we help to do.
You had mentioned about perhaps people not hearing as much about the elections here overseas. Are you finding there is more interest, though, from expats in Berlin and Germany in this particular U.S. elections than in the last national elections in 2022?
I think that the 2020 election, without dispute, was an incredibly visible election because we were dealing with an actor like Donald Trump. And of course, Democrats abroad, Democrats in general, were incredibly motivated to ensure that Donald Trump doesn't serve a second term. So in that respect, I think there's a bit less attention on the election because you're not dealing with the same really present fear of a second Trump presidency. At the same time, that is exactly what we're dealing with, right? We are dealing again with a matchup between the current administration potentially and likely, highly likely for the Republicans, Donald Trump. So I think we would all be remiss not to sort of see the same pressing election that we saw in 2020. And of course, globally, the challenges that we're dealing with both in the United States economy and globally are so big that we cannot sort of sit on our laurels and not take part in this election.
So what are you and Democrats abroad here in Berlin and in Germany doing to drive up the vote?
Yeah, our primary aim as Democrats abroad is to increase voter participation so that 7% to drive that. And in Germany, we're really glad that in 2020, it was extraordinarily high compared with the global average. So we were at 25% participation.
Wow, okay.
In Germany. Yeah. Of course, we want to increase that number even further. What we do is ensure that Americans living abroad, whether they have contact with us already, and we have almost 5,000 members that have contact with us just in Berlin and surrounding areas, that they know that they need to register, by what date they need to do that. And what's happening in the next few weeks is the Democratic global presidential primary, which is an opportunity for Democrats living overseas to vote in a primary only for Democrats abroad. So we're treated by the Democratic National Committee as sort of an additional state in the Democratic Party, and all of the votes cast in the global presidential primary, which you can do both physically and online, and in Berlin, we'll be doing that on March 5th and on March 10th. So please come and vote if you're a Democrat or want to register as a Democrat. And we give Democrats an opportunity to cast their ballot, and then those votes, of course, are counted, and we represent, Democrats Abroad represents the votes of all Democrats overseas at the National Convention in August. And so that's something that hopefully becomes more visible, of course, for the Democratic Party, and ensures that more people find out about us, more people know that they have Democrats Abroad as a real resource.
Well, what about Republicans or independents who maybe would like to vote and don't know where to go get information? Do you help them as well, even if you can't, like, take their votes and bring it to the convention floor?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a distinct difference between sort of the Democratic global presidential primary, which, of course, only Democrats vote in. You would need to join Democrats Abroad, which you can do on site during the primaries that we're holding. However, the tool votefromabroad.org, which we use to register voters, is a nonpartisan tool. So it is what we use, whether it's when we table at sort of marketplaces around Berlin or Germany as a whole, when we go into universities and advocate for students to register to vote. We use this nonpartisan tool and are completely nonpartisan and register, of course, everyone, every American citizen that's interested in voting in the general election and other elections.
What are some of the restrictions that people perhaps don't know about on U.S. citizens if you want to vote? For example, if you're a dual citizen, does that affect your ability to vote? Or if you are only recently a U.S. citizen, naturalized citizen, or if you have a criminal past? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, of course, there are laws in specific states about, for instance, people who are convicted felons voting. And, you know, we firmly believe that limits the right to vote and hope that states get rid of that barrier. But when it comes to voting from abroad, we can sort of answer those questions always individually because we've noticed there are a lot of individual cases. The primary sort of distinction, I think, is not when did you move out of the United States or for how long have you been a citizen. Every citizen is permitted to vote, but for the distinctions I just made. However, if you are living abroad, there is a definition that you have to fill out to sort of your overseas circumstance. You'll be asked whether or not you intend to return to the United States, for instance. Students, of course, who are voting from abroad because they're living in Berlin for a six-month period, we strongly encourage them, of course, to register for Democrats Abroad and to vote from abroad so that they're not caught off guard when they return to the United States, or maybe they're still physically here when the election takes place. But those are Americans who will be returning to the United States. And then tons of Americans living abroad don't know whether they might return to live in the United States in a year or two or 15. So they are intending to return. And then there might be Americans who classify themselves as Americans that will be staying overseas. That doesn't limit their right to vote in a general election. It limits their right sometimes, not in every state, to vote in state elections. So you wouldn't be casting a ballot for your local school board at the last address at which you are registered, or even for the congressional representative for that district. But you are, of course, allowed to vote in federal elections, so Senate elections and the federal presidential election.
Yeah, it's interesting because for California, I receive a ballot that has everything on there about things I know nothing about because I haven't been in California for a few years, but in terms of living there. Okay, great. Anything else you want to add?
I guess a big plug for our in-person global presidential primary, which will be held on Super Tuesday, March 5th. From 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. And then again, a second opportunity to vote in person on March 10th. That's Sunday from 3:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. And that will be held at the Center for International Educational Exchange, Gneisenauer Straße 27. And of course, we'd love to see Democrats there.
And in terms of the website where you can go to get the information for your state and to get registered. What's the URL for that?
The URL is votefromabroad.org, votefromabroad.org. And it really gives you play-by-play information based on your state. So please use that as a resource. And Democrats Abroad helps voters leading up to the election and now during registration ask those sort of nitty-gritty specific questions based on their state. So please reach out to us.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Constance.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to hear about what is happening in the U.S. presidential elections at the moment and what it means for us overseas. I'm joined via Zoom in New York by Jeremy Shapiro, Research Director of the European Council on Foreign Relations and a former advisor to the State Department during the Obama administration. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me.
So it's primary season, a time when voters choose the candidates that will represent their political parties in the general election in November. And tomorrow is known as Super Tuesday, the day 16 states and one U.S. territory hold their presidential primaries and caucuses. But even before the vote, it seems like the contest has shaped up to be a repeat of the 2020 election, Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a curious fact. I mean, it seems as if, certainly from reading the media and talking to people, that nobody really wants either of these candidates, and everyone is quite depressed about a repeat of the previous election. Broadly, both of them are sort of unpopular in the country. But what's important to note is that both of them are very popular in their own parties, and both of them are effectively unchallenged in the primaries. I think the media is working up a lot of different stories about how there are various challenges to Trump and Biden. But the truth is that it's been clear for several months both of them would coast to their respective nominations. And that reflects, I think, the fact that on a certain level, Biden is completely an incumbent and Trump is sort of an incumbent. And as we always see in American politics, incumbency is a massive advantage.
Have voters been turning out in large numbers for the primaries so far? And is that turnout as high as it was in 2020?
No, they haven't been turning out in very high numbers. The main reason is because they're basically not contested primaries. Everybody knows who's going to win. I mean, the numbers are actually they're higher than what Trump faced in 2020 in terms of turnout, because it's a more somewhat more contested primary. But for Biden, of course, they're much lower. And really, for Trump, they're not high by historical standards, and certainly quite low for, you know, there's always a sort of question as to whether you think about Trump as an incumbent or not. So turnout is high if he was an incumbent. Contestation is high if he was an incumbent, but contestation is low if he's not an incumbent, and turnout is low if he's not an incumbent.
So let's say this contest, Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, comes to pass in November. I know it's dangerous to do predictions given what happened with the 2016 and later the 2020 elections, but do you expect that turnout will increase if it's a repeat performance between these two?
Oh, absolutely. I expect turnout to be very high in November. I don't think we can assume that the turnout in the primaries has anything to do with turnout in November. In fact, I think both sides are making the case very strongly that this is an utterly vital election in which the future of the Republic is at stake. And I think that the polarization in the country may mean that nobody is really thrilled about either of these candidates, or few people are thrilled about either of these candidates, but everybody is utterly petrified about the opposing candidate. And so I think what will mostly generate turnout is people voting against the candidate. And that's particularly true for Donald Trump, who in his previous two elections has proven to be a turnout machine for both sides. He really gets Republicans to go to the polls to vote for him, and he gets Democrats to vote to the polls to vote against him, and a lot of independents to do one or the other.
Now, foreign policy is usually not something that takes front and center stage on the campaign trail in U.S. presidential elections. Is it different this time, considering there are two wars going on?
No, it's not really different. Foreign policy never takes center stage, but foreign policy is always relevant. It always has something to do with the election. And I think that's more or less the case this time. It's true that there are two wars, but America isn't really involved in either of them. I mean, I know that it feels like in Washington and in Berlin that America is involved, but from the standpoint of the country, we're not. There are no boots on the ground. It doesn't really occupy the media to that degree. You know, there is a sort of broader way in which foreign policy comes into elections. And it's not about any given foreign policy issue, because most foreign policy issues, you know, with the exception of things like immigration, don't really touch the United States. It's more about this kind of concept of leadership, this idea that the president is someone who can protect you, who can protect the country, who can project power and stability and strength. And I think that that's what you're seeing the candidates try to do with all of the foreign policy issues. It's not so much that the public is evaluating their stance on any given foreign policy issue. Immigration is an important exception. But on things like Gaza and Ukraine, the country doesn't really care. What they're evaluating is that a president is strong, that he can handle a problem, that he gives a sense of protection and stability. And that's why I think you see that the Biden campaign is so sensitive to these charges of weakness, and that you see Donald Trump constantly sort of talking about how strong he is and how he will protect people. So it's more of a feeling about the candidates than about any given foreign policy issue.
So is the prospect of a Biden-Trump rematch affecting how Joe Biden does foreign policy right now?
I think yes. I mean, the election, I would say, more than a Trump rematch, but I think the election is obviously relevant. And it's relevant in the way that I talked about. President Biden has committed himself, if you think about the wars, he's committed himself to supporting Ukraine and Israel in their respective wars. And he is not going to depart from that in any major way, less because people are so supportive of these wars. I think, as I said, I don't think they're terribly important for the mass of voters, but rather because he wants to demonstrate that he has a strong foreign policy, that he can follow through on his commitments and plans, and that he has a plan more than what the plan is. And so I think you will see the president being very wary about changing policies, about showing weakness, about taking difficult compromises in the time leading up to the election.
So what are the most important races to watch on Tuesday?
I don't think any of them are important. I know that it's not what you're supposed to say in the media. There was the Michigan primary last week. Everybody in the lead up to that was talking about how much they would win by. As if that was somehow significant, when actually it's really just depends on who actually bothers to show up. I don't think that there is any information that is going to come from any of these primaries in the next week. Frankly, we haven't had any information really since before the primaries. I know that people would say that there was information in Iowa and New Hampshire, but I just don't really see it. You know, I think for better or for worse, your listeners can sort of tune out until the conventions if they want. I mean, there's going to be a lot happening, of course, and people are going to be covering it incessantly, and particularly Trump's various legal issues and things. But there isn't really going to be any developments in the race until the summer.
Jeremy, is there anything else you want to add?
I think that one of the things that's interesting about the general election is that the Biden campaign, because Trump is such a controversial and polarizing character, has decided to make the campaign about Trump. And really, you can see in already that Biden is mostly talking about Trump even more than he's talking about his record. And that the Trump campaign has a sort of incentive to make it about Biden, but isn't going to do that because Trump is a sort of incurable narcissist and can't talk about anything but himself. And so both campaigns have decided to make the election about Trump. And so it's going to be about Trump. It really does feel like, strangely, that this isn't going to be a referendum on the incumbent. It's going to be a lot more like 2020, a referendum on Donald Trump.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Next, we hear a different perspective from Washington. I'm joined via Zoom by Gary Schmidt, a political scientist who is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Even before Super Tuesday, it seems like November is shaping up as a repeat of the 2020 election, Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's most likely because when you're a president or a former president, you tend to have built up the control over party and party regulars. And so the result is that when you go into primaries, you have this very large advantage, basically shape the party in your own image. Unlike in 2016, for example, when Trump won the nomination, he really didn't have 50% of the Republican Party behind him until very, very late in the primary season. And then even then it was in states that he wasn't going to win, like New York and Maryland in those primaries. But this time around, he's, you know, got more than 50% and sometimes 60%. And so therefore, you know, he really does have the majority within the primaries. And President Biden is, in his case, again, he really does control the levers of the party at this point. And it's very hard for somebody to challenge him given that position.
So does this explain why Nikki Haley is having such a hard time beating Trump in any of these primaries so far, even in her home state? Or is this a turnout issue?
Well, it's a bit of both. I mean, the one thing that's happening is that, again, Trump, as opposed to 2016, really does have a majority. Now, the problem with that majority is that historically, you know, less than 30% of eligible voters actually vote in primaries. And so we're talking about a very small slice of the electorate, Republicans. And so therefore, her appeal is to, let's say, 35 to 40% of Republicans. But her larger appeal is to a broader electorate, independents. And those people don't vote in the primaries. And so therefore, you know, she has a harder time gaining votes in primaries, which are typically where the more activist, more ideological leaning voters vote.
You talked a little bit about this, but if you could elaborate some, what impact would Donald Trump winning the Republican nomination again have on the Republican Party? I mean, he's already putting his daughter-in-law in charge of the GOP.
Well, in the short term, it certainly doesn't make the party more appealing to the 40% of independents who will be voting in the general election. I mean, party identification in the United States has gone down considerably, so that it's basically 25% for Republicans and 27%, I think, is the latest for Democrats in party identification. So there's some 40% plus that you need to appeal to. And if Trump captures the mechanisms of the party, the fundraising and other things, but then loses, then the party really is in dire straits of having to rebuild itself altogether. I mean, this will be successive elections that he's lost, and one could say even the congressional races have been lost because of the Trump-like character of the Republican Party. So in some respects, it'll be like Phoenix. You know, the Republican Party will have to recreate itself if he loses. If he wins, then, you know, we're talking about a Republican Party that will be shaped by Trump and Trump supporters for another, you know, decade almost.
So it won't be the Republican Party of the past.
Well, as somebody who first worked for Senator Moynihan in the Senate, but then moved to the Reagan White House, I can guarantee you that politics is nowhere near like that from those days. Yeah, no, the Reagan Republican Party will just simply disappear.
Is the prospect of Donald Trump being the Republican nominee affecting Joe Biden's approach to foreign policy in 2024? I mean, we've seen some subtle shifts over here, but I'm wondering what your take is on that.
I think Biden is also worried about his base. And so some of his earlier instincts about the alliance and supporting Ukraine, while they're still there, they've been trimmed somewhat. And that's particularly seen in the course of the Israeli-Gaza war. You know, Biden has a long tradition of support for transatlantic relations, and I still think that exists, just that I think the more pressing problem for him these days is on the domestic front. And so what you see in the White House most recently is a lot less putting the president out front on foreign policy issues. Now, recently, because of the need to pass a supplemental to get Ukraine aid, he's been a little bit more forthright about it, but it's also in the context of the campaign, which is try to blame Republicans for not supporting or not passing the bill. I mean, the majority of Republicans actually support passing aid for Ukraine. It's just the minority within the House in particular that prevents that from going forward. So Biden has seen that this is an advantage to talk about politically for the election by complaining about this rather radical isolationist part of the party. And my point is, I guess, is that in general, over the course of the administration's years, it's not really been as much upfront about foreign policy. And now it's kind of backing into being a little bit more upfront about foreign policy, both in the case of the Gaza war, trying to placate part of the Democratic base, and in the case of Ukraine, using the failure to pass the supplemental as a way to ding the Republicans, with the advantage coming in the general election where most of the American public is in support of aid to Ukraine.
Well, Donald Trump has bragged that he will end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours, and he's made some threatening noises toward NATO members who aren't meeting the 2% of their GDP spending on defense. I mean, that's sort of a continuation of what he was doing when he was president. So if he wins the election, what will U.S. relations with NATO and the EU look like?
The fact that we don't know is the big problem. You cannot be the leader of an alliance or the leader of the liberal world order if your allies and partners are uncertain about what you're going to do from day to day. So even though one doesn't know whether Trump would pull out of NATO or, you know, cut some deal with Putin or the like, it's just the sheer fact of the uncertainty that's so unsettling, I think. Now, having said that, you know, in 2018, it appears that Trump really was determined to pull out of NATO, and he was prevented from doing so by the assistance of the national security affairs that he had on his team at that point. Those people won't be around the next time if he is elected. And so therefore, the prospects of not just being unsettled, but also doing some real damage to alliance relations is very present.
Joe Biden is having his own issues with Democrats, especially those who are progressive or on the left. Do you think he can win against Donald Trump?
Yes, I do, because I think he's probably appeals more to the independents than Donald Trump does. But having said that, he's also, you know, has problems of having this, you know, an economy that middle America thinks is going well. And then on top of which, in some of these key states, the marginal value of some of the voters in his base, like in Michigan, means that he has to appeal to more progressive and more left-leaning elements in the party. You know, that means that the appeal to the middle is less. So it's a hard circle to square. And I would just say that the truth is, virtually any other Democrat would be Donald Trump. And conversely, almost any other Republican would be Joe Biden. So we have this odd situation in which the electoral system is putting up two candidates that neither of which, if you were to step back and say, are these the optimal people to run for president, you would say no.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Let me just walk through this a bit. I mean, because the parties are so evenly split in terms of party identification, and you combine that with the primary system that produces candidates that are probably more to the left or more to the right than both elements within their party, but also in the general public, what you get is, you know, a majority sometimes in either congressional elections and or at presidential level, but you're filled with a government that are with people that push an agenda that the middle doesn't always agree with. So you get this kind of whipsaw effect in the American politics over the last decade and a half, where one party gains the majority in one house or two houses or even the presidency, but then takes actions and puts forward policies that wind up not being supported by the larger middle, and then they lose the next election. And so you get this kind of back and forth where there's not stability in the American political system, both in policies and in the direction of, you know, our foreign policy. It's a system that needs fixing for sure.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Gary.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm your host, Soraya Sarhadi Nelson. Our senior producer is Dina El Sayed. Our social media editor is Noor Trabelsi. And our intern is Eden Brockman. Our podcast is funded by a grant administered by the German Ministry for Economic Affairs and Climate Action. And our partners are Goethe Institute, the Checkpoint Charlie Foundation, and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. All Common Ground Berlin episodes are available wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X at CG Berlin Podcast.